If you heard about a good-looking military veteran, beloved in his ranching community for saving a little girl's life as a volunteer firefighter, you might be surprised if some enterprising political kingmaker didn't recruit that vet to run for the Texas legislature. The guy would be exactly the kind of outsider who appeals to Republican voters in particular, a shoo-in with the support of the right donors, donors the kingmaker has on speed dial. So let's say this veteran hero outsider actually wins a seat in Austin. What happens then? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That setup is the starting premise for the new novel, Mr. Texas. And because the Ledge is a major character here, we also get mysterious power brokers with quid pro quo expectations, star-crossed love, well, at least sexual attraction across party lines, culture wars, and lawmakers on the lam. It is a wild ride, but it's as insightful as it is entertaining, and I'm delighted to have Lawrence Wright here to talk about it. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a playwright, a screenwriter, and of course the author of Mr. Texas and a lifelong Texan. Larry, welcome back to Think.
Chris, it's great to be back.
There are so many larger-than-life characters here that nevertheless ring so true that anybody who even casually, I think, follows Texas politics would want to ask, is there something unique about Texas, or is there something about state-level politics everywhere that is just inherently even wilder than what happens in D.C.?
In a way, they're both true. In some respects, all the action right now in politics is in the states. You know, everything is changing. It's at state level, and then it affects national politics. But is there something about Texas that makes these characters larger than life? I think part of it is that we tend to cherish our political figures even for their flaws. And going back, I mean, some of the characters I've drawn upon in this book, like Bob Bullock, you know, five wives, drunk, you know, had all these problems. Everybody loved him because they knew that he loved Texas and he wouldn't do anything to hurt the state. You know, that sentiment is kind of foreign nowadays in our politics, but that was such a key. And one of the things that stimulated me to want to write about Texas now is this: the distance that it's gone from the Texas of old, whatever its flaws. You know, Texas was not corrupt, for one thing. You know, we only impeached one statewide official in our history until lately. That was James Paw Ferguson in 1917.
And then his wife took over, right?
The voters didn't much care because they put Ma in office. You know? So, you know, I have always been enchanted by the characters that come to life in Texas politics.
So the first person we meet here is this guy, L.D. Sparks, who has arrived in this remote corner of West Texas, ostensibly to attend the funeral of a longstanding Democrat who's been a state rep there for years. Really, he's looking for a Republican to slide into this tantalizingly open seat, and he finds Sonny Lam. No one could be more surprised to be tapped than Sonny himself.
Right. But in a way, he's been waiting for opportunity. You know, he thinks of himself as a loser, and he's like so many ranchers, like all ranchers out in West Texas, is suffering from the drought. They're selling off their herd. Their prospects are not good, and he wants to make a mark, and he has an idea about what could help, which is underneath this cracking dry soil is a vast salty aquifer. And desalination plant might be the very ticket for solving the problems of the drought in West Texas. So that's what motivates him politically. He wants to get this bill passed.
Sonny has a soft spot for his own cattle.
Yes, he does.
We learn right away that he is not a hard-nosed person.
Yeah, he's a little too tender in his sentiments to be a cold-blooded rancher in the taking them to the market and stuff like that. That's a hard thing. And he's named all his cows, and he has this one bull, Joaquin, who really has stolen his heart, and he comes close to parting with that particular animal, and that's part of the story that helps us introduce Sonny to the reader and his his love of, you know, his love of creatures. And, you know, he loves being a part of that. He can walk, he feels like a kindergarten teacher walking into class when he goes out into the field.
Sonny, I love this detail. He saves not only this little girl in a fire, but then he goes back in and saves her horse. I mean, you can see why somebody like L.D. Sparks would be eager to package this story for a particular audience of voters. But that detail made me think about the fact that, you know, as much as the mythology of Texas extends far beyond this state, we have sort of bought into that mythology ourselves.
You know, people have asked me, who is Mr. Texas? And, you know, obviously Sonny Lam, our hero, is in some respects. But that's not really the correct answer, in my opinion. There's a campaign ad that is made for him. And he is draped in all this mythic lore. The Alamo, his ancestor who fell at the Alamo. You know, he's a rancher. He's a cowman. He rides a horse, you know. So he's loaded with all these Texas stereotypes and this, you know, very artistic director. Knows how to feed the ideas of, you know, Texas past and drape this guy in all these ideas. But, you know, using a drone shot as he rides into the sunset and this sort of thing. The Mr. Texas is the creature she made him into. It's not him exactly. It's the modern Texan looking back at all the history that we love and, you know, but is now just a part of the myth that continues to animate the state.
Sonny is not only a political outsider, he's a guy who never he never cast a vote before.
I know. He's totally politically ignorant.
So the assumption is he'll be very tractable.
Yes, that's exactly. The lobbyist is named L.D. Sparks, and that L.D.'s great hope is that Sonny will be his pet vote, and he can ride him through the House of Representatives and then maybe on to higher office. And it all, just like the guy who passed away, you know, that was a loss for LD because Walter, the deceased, was always a reliable vote for him.
Sonny is perceptive enough to know his wife is the brains of that relationship, and Lola is sort of capable and pragmatic and fearless in a way that has made Texas proud of its women for a very long time.
Yes, but, you know, she's a particular kind of woman. And I remember years ago when I was working at Texas Monthly, there was an issue that was about cowgirls. And there was a cowgirl, I think she was on the cover, and she was attractive, not pretty, but, you know, she had some resolute quality, and she had a little scar on her cheek, and in a way, sort of a Texas beauty mark, you know. And I thought, this woman has never really been written about, you know, the modern cowgirl, you know, who's, you know, facing who owns the ranch, really, is her ranch. And I was very intrigued by her, and I filed that image away in my mind that one day I was going to try to find a way to write about that particular woman, and that is who Lola Lam is.
This story also makes it clear that there remain pretty significant double standards for women in Texas politics. Valerie, the opponent for this open seat, is a mother, but she is divorced, and she has committed the cardinal sin of having her daughters live with their father in California.
In California,
of all places.
As much as anything else, it's the California angle that really crucifies her. She's a hardworking public servant, and she knows a lot about governing. But Sonny is, you know, he's a man, he's attractive, and he's not encumbered with the problems that Valerie has, in particular her association with Planned Parenthood. And that plus, you know, the lack of custody of her children, issues that should have nothing to do with the election, that's what sinks her.
What the Lambs really want, Sonny and Lola, is a baby. And there's this sort of secondary narrative arc that runs throughout the story. And I wonder how much you were thinking about this parallel between the desire for a baby and Sonny's desire to have kind of a legacy himself, a professional mark in the world.
Yeah. At one point I wrote more about that more explicitly, but I think it's understood that, you know, he wants to leave something behind. And, you know, going to Washington and creating legislation is one way of doing that. But he's desperate for children. And Lola, in particular, you know, her family is loaded with children. Her brothers and sisters are incredibly fertile. And the absence of children in their lives is heartbreaking to her. And it becomes an issue at one point in the book where some children, illegal migrants, come across their land, and she's caught trying to decide what's the right thing to do for these children. She doesn't have children herself, but she wants to do something with them. But you know, so many of the issues that we're dealing with, you know, abortion, immigration, you know, death penalty, all these things are a feature of trans bathrooms and so on. The very things that we talk about are part of the novel because I wanted it to feel like, you know, you're sitting in the actual House of Representatives debating these very points.
This novel has been in the works for, what, something like 20, 25 years for you?
Oh, my God. It started out in the Ann Richards administration.
A lot has changed since then.
Well, back then, Sonny Lam was a Democrat. Mm. And but, you know, as I wrote this in so many different iterations, Chris. It started out as a movie script and it never got made. And then it was a play where we had two productions in Austin. And a Broadway producer came down and said it should be a musical. So I started writing music with my pal, Marsha Ball, the great piano player and R&B singer. And then the producer changed her mind and said it should be a television series. So I sold a pilot to HBO, and I was, you know, okay, here we go. And then they fired my executive and dumped all his projects, so I had no musical and no HBO series. And so during the pandemic, I asked my agent, what can I do with this project because I love it so much? And he said, podcast. And so I wrote 8 episodes, and Marsha and I, my son Gordon, wrote 50 songs. We loved it, doing a creative explosion. But it was, you know, podcasts are meant to be cheap. They're meant to be like our conversation right now, two people talking into the microphone. But, you know, when you have a cast of 15 and you got a full band and stuff like that, it gets to be more expensive than your typical podcast. And so finally it occurred to me, I should just write it as a novel. You know, I don't know why it didn't start out that way, but I took this long journey through every possible format, writing about these same people. But each iteration, I learned more about them. And, you know, having written it as a movie and then, you know, writing it with music and stuff like that, all of those things took a place in the creation of the novel that it wouldn't have been there if I hadn't had this long struggle to find the right way to tell the story.
Is there something you can't do with the novel, though, that you could have done with those other media?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the reasons we have movies is, you know, there's so much you don't have to explain in a movie. And you sometimes just the look will tell a whole story. And all the description of the landscape and stuff like that, the camera just sweeps around and does that work for you. So, you know, they're totally different mediums. But on the other hand, the novel is much more commodious in what it allows you to say and what you can tell and how deeply you can go into people's minds, which is something movies don't allow. And, you know, in that sense, it's a unique form. And I think that because of that, I think that it's going to endure.
Larry, Sonny arrives in Austin for his orientation and promptly has a panic attack and passes out.
It happens. You know, I mean, the question, every other year there's a new class of legislators, and they come from all over Texas, and they've worked so hard to get elected, but now they actually have to govern. And for some, you know, it's frightening, and they're moreover, you're faced with, you got to hire an office staff, you know, you got to find all these people, you got to create, satellite offices, you have to brush up on the laws, you have to learn the rules, you have to make friends, you have to take positions on issues that you never even knew were issues, and all of this takes place within a very compressed period of time. And so panic is a real feature of a new lawmaker's existence.
So Sonny is lucky enough to have Wanda in his office. And I feel like there is probably a Wanda in many offices in Austin.
Well, there are two kinds of legislative aides. You know, there are the pretty ones that, my lobbyist was trying to hire for Sonny because they are attractive and they bring in other lawmakers to kind of stare at the goods. And then the people that really have the experience and the knowledge. And sometimes they are put out to pasture. And Wanda is one of those people. She's elderly. She's on a walker. But boy, does she know the ropes. And so she's his great ally. She knows everything he doesn't know.
There's this wonderful line that will stick with me when she tells Sonny that the Texas legislature is run on one emotion alone, and that is fear.
Fear, yeah. Everybody's afraid. It was one of the revelations to me when I was researching this and talking to lawmakers and so on. You know, there are snares set out. You know, they're like some of these policy forums that are really right-wing will push a vote that for the sole purpose of screwing a member. You know, I know people will read the book and think, oh, that's outrageous. It's not. It happens all the time. There are absurd votes, you know, that, you know, you have to, you would hand out free malted milk to shotgun owners. I mean, something almost as crazy as that. And you think, that's ridiculous. You won't vote for it. And then mailers would arrive in your district saying Sonny Lam is against the Second Amendment. The whole point of that vote is to do that to that person. And there's a classic example that when I started this book so long ago in different form, Pete Laney was the Speaker of the House and was a great friend of this project. He said, it's been the dream of my life to have a television series set in the Texas House of Representatives. So maybe that dream will come true. But I asked him, what would a lobbyist do to a member to really screw him up? And he said, well, you could put a toxic waste dump in his district, and that would do the trick. And so that became a part of the book. I mean, it happened in real life. They would bring down solid waste from New York City.
The sludge, right.
And this really happened. And it called the poo-poo choo-choo. And honestly, Chris, in some ways the book just wrote itself because all I had to do was talk to people and get their memories and their insights. And, you know, there was so much that I would never have imagined on my own had I not spent the time learning the ropes with these people.
I mean, Sonny's first mistake is that once he is elected to do this job for which he may not be well qualified, mm-hmm. his intentions are to follow his conscience and try to serve his district. And that is not what he was selected to do.
Yeah. Well, it was inevitable that he and LD were going to cross swords. And Sonny didn't allow himself to think about it. He just so much wanted this job. And he didn't think about the bill of obligation that was going to come due. And that's where the climax of the book comes from, is when they split the sheets and Sonny learns that without LD's help, he's pretty helpless.
Tell us who Odell Peoples is in this book.
Okay, now I'm going to say this because people think that it's over the top. It's not. There are, Odell Peoples is an oil man. He's, a Midland figure from the beginning, but now has a radio show in Houston. And I drew from a lot of different sources to create this particular guy. But what the readers may not know is that, Texas politics is really, in many ways, has been steered by some billionaires from Midland, and, you know, who have a lot of these lawmakers in their pocket, and they will do anything to get rid of them. And the hatred for instance, gays is shocking. You know, just shocking to me that, you know, these big money people, there's one who's a doctor in Houston who is, has a show on Dan Patrick, our lieutenant governor's radio station, and is in business with him, and he talks about homo Nazis and things like that. They're the money bags. Those are the people that are giving out the dough, and they have tremendous influence. So I made it a little bit comic, but it frankly, it's one of the major things that's wrong with Texas politics is the funnel of money that comes out of the oil business into the pockets of Texas lawmakers.
I promise not to spoil too many of the events of the book, but there is a scene in which all of these social issues come before the legislature, and there is some pretty preposterous legislation proposed that they're talking about. And what we quickly learn is that the people whose names are attached to this, the people who are voting on it or feel pressured to vote in favor of it, often don't believe in it, don't believe that it's important. Talk a little bit about what you've learned about why anyone would stick their neck out for legislation they think is probably morally wrong or at the very least unnecessary.
Well, there are people that are simply unprincipled, and so, but let's not talk about them. There are issues where it would be the end of your career. And is it worth it? You know, are you ready to, you know, vote against the gun legislation? You know, say goodbye to your career. Is it worth it? If you don't vote for it, then you'll be primaried. And if you vote against it, it'll be a marginal vote that will, you know, sink your career. So you have good people voting for bad bills. And it happens in any political body, I'm sure. But in Texas, a lot of these issues that are dealt with in the book are so highly politicized that there's no margin for people to step out of the line and try to find some sort of compromise. And that's why, you know, we don't have any progress on, you know, regulating guns. That's why we haven't made any progress on health care. It's why our schools are still in bad shape. You know, all of these things are affected by the fact that the room to maneuver in Texas politics has been so narrowed down by the big money bosses that come out of Midland.
The irony is that it feels as if the Texas legislature, which meets for about 6 months every 2 years, was set up deliberately to avoid the problem of career politicians very closely safeguarding their political career. They were meant to be part-time lawmakers.
Yeah, well, what's happened is that, you know, this is where the levers of power are, and naturally it draws money. And, it, you know, and lobbyists and influencers are going to be around trying to change things. In Texas, I would say this. This has been a one-party state. It was a one-party state when it was a Democrat, all-blue state, back when this project began. It's a one-party state now when it's all entirely red. And along with being in power and uncontested comes the door to corruption is opened, and there's not a correction. There's no legitimate party that can fight back and moderate things. And that's where, you know, we are right now. And it's not just the fault of our politicians. It's the fault of the voters who don't go to vote. You know, there's no law against voting in primaries. We could change the, you know, politics in Texas overnight if the same people that went in the general election went to the primaries.
Another fascinating character in this story is this other freshman lawmaker, Angela Martinez.
Yeah.
And she's a Democrat raised by this formidable activist mother. This job is like the destiny she refused for as long as she could.
Yeah. You know, I was her mother, Leticia Martinez. I was fascinated by, you know, how back in the early days of La Raza Unida, you know, they came out of the spinach fields in South Texas, and the formation of that all had to do with cheerleaders in the high school. And I was intrigued by the fact that, you know, the city council wouldn't allow the schools to select another Hispanic. They only had one Hispanic cheerleader, and that was all they were allowed. What a silly thing to argue about it, but it became an immense political crux in changed the politics of Texas. And I'm so fascinated by the, you know, I don't want to leave those things on the side of the road. Moments in Texas that nobody knows about that are really formative. And so I created this character, Leticia, who is Angela's mom and becomes mayor of San Antonio and a formidable figure there, but wants to be the architect of Angela's life. And unfortunately, the two women are so alike in their stubbornness that, you know, they're fighting all along. But eventually, after Leticia passes, then Angela adopts the role that her mother had carved out for her.
Is there room, given where we are today with Texas politics, for something like a reset? Could we ever reshape the way politics is done in this state?
Well, we will someday. Somebody's going to break the spell.
You think so?
I do, because the demography is such that it's inevitable. You know, the cities are growing. You look around. I mean, you know,
we've been saying this for 30 years.
I know. But liberals are blue. You know, the cities are blue, and even Fort Worth. And so, you know, and they're the growth centers. And Texas is now a majority minority state. Yes, it's true that a lot of the Hispanics have drifted into the Republican Party. But one reason for that is there has never been a charismatic, electable Hispanic to offer for statewide office. This is not the, you know, not Henry Cisneros, not the Castro boys. You know, just they've always been afraid of losing. The difference in California is that, you know, there are Hispanic candidates. And the other big difference is California is unionized and Texas is not. So, you know, those two things explain a lot, I think, about the alienation of the Hispanic population from the Democratic Party, which has been so feckless that it hasn't been able to deliver anything to them. But my contention is, if when Beto was running against Cruz, if, for instance, either of the Castro twins had offered themselves for governor or lieutenant governor or both of them, somebody would have been elected. They're just, you know, but the Democratic Party in Texas is so handicapped. And, you know, when Beto was running, they asked him for money. You know, right now it is not a functioning political party.
What do you think it's like for the Castro brothers to be thought of as somewhat interchangeable in these conversations?
I understand why they would feel that way. I mean, they are, although identical twins, they are different. They have different political destinies. And I spent a little time with Julian, and I recognize that, you know, he just didn't have the fire to do it. And it's, you know, it's people put a lot of projection on our public figures. And it's, I'm deeply sympathetic to what it would be like to be that person and have all these longings and also a lot of hatred directed in their direction. You know, just it's being a politician in Texas is, you know, in many respects, an overwhelming and sometimes frightening experience.
I'm really curious about whether some version of the Paxton affair would have made it into this novel had it happened before you went to press.
Well, I think they must have been thinking about my book sales when they took keep it in the news. And there's nothing stopping me from writing a sequel. I do mention the Attorney General in the book, and you know what. What I didn't factor in into the writing of the book, it was before Paxton, is that I didn't expect Texas to to take this turn towards corruption and unaccountability. That's never really been a Texas problem. It's not like Illinois, where you had 4 out of 7 governors in prison, 2 of them serving the overlapping terms. It's not like New York or New Jersey. We just haven't had those kinds of, people talk about Sharpstown, but that took place, 35, 40 years ago. For the most part, the landscape of Texas politics has been about influence and, the drift towards, right-wing culture war. But it hasn't been about corruption. And, Dan Morales, who was the last, statewide Hispanic, went to prison. And so, we've had accountability. But that seems to be lacking now, and I think it's a dreadful state for Texas to be in right now.
Larry, given all that we've discussed, you have got to explain to me why you told Texas Monthly that you thought seriously about running for governor just a few years ago. What did you want with the job?
Oh, well, I'm grateful that I didn't do it in many respects, but I had been writing for The New Yorker. I covered the legislative session 2 sessions ago, and Joe Strauss was the speaker at the time, and Texas was already been engaged deeply in culture war, but that session was really ugly. And the bathroom bill and all of that came up, I could see that nothing useful was being discussed or passed. It was all about divisiveness. And I thought, why do we even have a state or a city? The whole point of these political entities is twofold, as far as I could see. One is to create jobs, which Texas does a superb job of. It's amazing just in Austin, we've grown so fast. And yet our unemployment rate never goes up. We create jobs more quickly than people come. And the same is true of Dallas and other big cities in Texas. And so, in that sense, we're doing a great job. But then the other purpose for these political entities is to create community. And that's where we're really failing. We're creating disunity, and it's spreading throughout the country. And one of the reasons why this is more important than just Texas is that Texas is growing so quickly that by 2050, it is scheduled to be nearly as large as California and New York combined. So, each of them lost an electoral vote in the last census, and they both came to Texas. So as they diminish and Texas grows, we become so central to American politics that there is no, beyond Texas, there's not much left on the table. But I don't think Texans are aware of how much power we are gaining. And we haven't assumed the responsibility to take on that power. We haven't educated our kids. We're doing a really mediocre job of educating children. Our health care, we have the largest uninsured population in the country. So we're not taking care of our people. The hatred that ADL just put out a thing about Texas being a center of right-wing hatred. And the thing that lawmakers care about the most, that in terms of being the best place to do business, we've sunk out of those top ranks. So we are slipping. And that is one of the motivators that got me to thinking, well, if nobody else is going to do this, the Democratic Party at that point had gotten up to December before the primaries without a candidate. And I thought, well, if you don't have anybody, and so I contacted them, and I learned some lessons from that experience, Chris.
Like what?
For one thing, it's not just my decision. My family, I wasn't thinking about them. And my wife really didn't want me to do it. And she didn't like exposing our life to, in particular, she couldn't imagine having our name on billboards in people's yards and stuff like that. And there were things that I would have to give up. I love my career. I enjoy my writing life. I love to be a reporter. I'd have to give that up. I would have to ask people for things that I would feel self-conscious about. And I'd have to be subject to the kinds of attacks that people in politics are normally subject to. And all of those things were formidable. I felt so strongly that somebody had to do something, that I came so close to pulling the trigger. But finally, I realized I couldn't carry my own household. And I did think it could be fun to campaign. You know, I had asked Mark McKinnon to be my campaign manager, and I was going to model the campaign on Pappy Leo Daniels' campaign, where, you know, I'm in a band and we could go around the state like Pappy Leo Daniel did with Bob Wills and his band.
Well, you're not going to get into Kinky Friedman territory there, though.
Yeah, I'd like to be taken a little more seriously. I remember when Kinky announced for governor, and after the book festival, I saw him standing outside the governor's mansion, and I said, "Well, could be your home, Kinky." And he said, "It's just going to be a giant party barn." So that was his goal.
Tell me about writing songs. That had this become a musical?
Yeah.
What kinds of songs? You said 55 that you and your son came up with?
I think it was 53.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
Marcia Ball, yeah.
Country music?
Our challenge was...
It's not a hip-hop musical, I'm guessing.
Well, there is a rap song in there. Our challenge was to write songs that reflected all the variety of the state. I mean, just like the House of Representatives, which I am so fascinated by, 150 members from all over the state representing 30 million Texans. And, you know, they are teachers and NFL ball players and, you know, mayors and billionaires and nurses and so on. And they come from Palo Pinto County or, you know, New Braunfels or wherever. And it's a concentrate of Texas placed in this one room. And I love that, but I wanted the music to be reflective of the variety of people that create Texas as well. And so we have, you know, songs in Spanish. We have, you know, doo-wop songs and rock and polkas. You know, all of these songs were just, it was just marches. It was just, honestly, Chris, there was so much to draw from. And I never had more fun. I never had more fun than, you know, than writing these songs. And then we decided, you know, to actually record some of these songs for the audiobook, which are a part of that.
Is there one that is kind of encompassing the theme of the entire novel?
Well, I guess the one that I would point to is Texas, My Home.
No matter wherever it is that I roam, there's only one place I will ever go home. Texas, you gotta love her. If you need another chance, she'll always be there. When it's a friend you need, there'll be someone there. It's why I love Texas. Texas, my home.
I'd like for it to become the new Texas State song. I think our Texas State song is silly. Texas, our Texas, all hail the mighty state. You know, it's kind of blustery and so on. So I love Texas, My Home. The other one that was an interesting song that reflects who are my lobbyist, L.D. Sparks, is. And it's called The Man Who Holds the Strings.
I hold the strings on human beings. I make them laugh. I make them dance. I make them cry. They're in a trance. I pick them up or make them fall. I let them walk into a wall. They love me so, I'm all they know. I'm the man who holds the strings.
That's his job. He holds the strings. And I envision if we ever do get the musical made, that when he sings it, you have the legislators like marionettes in the background dancing around. But, you know, it's interesting with when you're writing a musical, you know, you have the characters face a dilemma. A song naturally arises, you know, and that's, so there's so many occasions for songs. That's one of the things that was really miraculous. We had so many opportunities to write and reflect the characters that we're writing about.
You know, you talked about the pressures that lawmakers are under to sort of go along with what their party's agenda is. I've been so fascinated to follow the pressure that Governor Abbott is placing on lawmakers to go along with school vouchers, which maybe you can sort of set this up for us briefly, is really a challenge for rural lawmakers whose constituents may not have other options, may not benefit at all from a school voucher program.
Yeah, and then they'll see their income, you know, for the to support their public schools diminish because it's going to the cities where there are, you know, multiple schools to choose from. The other thing is that in small towns, you know, like the high school, it's the center of town. It's where everybody goes to school. It's where they make their friends. It's where their kids go to school and where the sports are and stuff like that. It's an institution that is so central to smaller towns in Texas. And they're, you know, these lawmakers from those areas are united against this. And the governor is trying to ram it through by just, you know, forcing them to stay in Austin until they agree to his project. If he could demonstrate that, you know, that he's not going to harm public education through this bill, then, you know, who would stand in his way? But that's something he's not been able to do. Texas doesn't support public education enough now at any rate. And so diminishing that level of support is going to make the state less educated than it is now.
At the heart of it, this novel is really about someone making a decision. Will they sort of stand up for what they actually want, or will they coalesce to what is desired of them?
Yeah.
What have you learned about what it takes to be that person who does not justify a shift in their values based on what's expedient?
This is what my hero faces, you know, and as he's coming to understand who he is. And it's his mistakes that lead him to, you know, the crossroads that you're describing. And I think that it's going to sound corny, but what really holds him together is love. He loves his wife. He loves his state. He comes to love some of the people that he works with. And he realizes that he can violate that love by making the wrong choice. And finally, that was a fence that he couldn't go past. So, you know, there are other things that probably are motivating him, but, you know, basically he's a person who's capable of loving so much that he will take losses that other people might not accept.
Do you ever feel like you have to defend Texas to your colleagues at a fancy publication like The New Yorker? Do you have to explain the state because people have one-dimensional understandings of what this place is?
Well, that was my last Texas book, God Save Texas. My editor at The New Yorker, David Remnick, asked me to explain Texas because nobody there understands why I live here. Hmm. And they think it's quaint and maybe dangerous. You know, Texas emanates this, you know, don't tread on me thing. You know, it's a scary place for people that are not in Texas. And they think they're going to get shot if they get off, you know, the airplane and walk down the street in Dallas. You know, I worked for Texas Monthly for several years. And then when I left, I thought I would never write about Texas because I didn't want to be a regional writer. But if, you know, when David asked that of me, I realized, I mean, it's been 30 years since I'd written anything about Texas. And I realized during that period of time, my whole life had been changed by being a Texan, shaped by it, and I hadn't examined it. I hadn't really asked myself, why am I here? You know, what does it mean to me? And why should I be in Texas rather than New York or Washington or Los Angeles? Each of these places would have a claim on my career, and Texas really didn't. It's not, you know, there's no publishing industry here. There's, you know, Hollywood is far away, and, you know, the center of power is Washington, D.C., and I spend a lot of time in all those places. But I live here for reasons that are somewhat inscrutable. But for me, it's the sense of home, and that no place else provides. You know, the accents, the food, the customs, even the things that I hate are familiar to me in a way that things I would hate in New York would not be. So I'd rather be with the things I hate here than the things I would hate in New York.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a playwright and a screenwriter and a journalist. His new novel is called Mr. Texas. Larry, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for making the time.
Chris, I may always make time for you. I love your show, so thank you for having me on again.
Thank you. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.